good day.
Today is Friday, 10th July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, today, the things I think which are of most interest and importance are a succession of statements made by senior Russian officials following the NATO summit meeting in Ankara. And the first person whose comments I will discuss is the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. Now, Lavrov is currently on a tour of Africa. He was in Niger, where he attended a meeting of West African states. He then went to Mozambique, where he met the Foreign Minister of Mozambique and other senior Mozambique officials. And over the course of a press conference, he made the following comments. The West continues to make hypocritical calls for a negotiated solution. Negotiated solutions were reached back in 2014, 2015, and 2019. In all of these cases, the West's guarantees were dismantled by the West itself. They all proved total lies. Besides, there was a negotiated solution between Russia and Ukraine in 2022, but the West undermined it openly and publicly. We no longer trust the West's declared willingness to find a negotiated solution. Our reserve of good faith and hope has run completely dry. So notice that Lavrov is not making any distinction here between the Europeans and the Americans. He's simply talking about the West, and he says that the Russians have lost all expectations or hopes of ever coming to any kind of resolution of the Ukraine conflict with the West. Now, that's Lavrov, but another person who has been talking is Putin's spokesman, Peskov, who, as I have pointed out many times, comes across to me very much as his master's loyal voice. I've never myself had any doubt that any statement that he makes is a reflection, accurately reflects Vladimir Putin's opinions. Anyway, this is what he said, and again, this is following the NATO summit meeting. He said that NATO declaring Russia a threat represent an aggressive step. This obliges us to be strong, to be self-confident, and continue our consistent policy. First, for the development of our country, technologically, economically, and to ensure and protect our interests amid NATO's aggressive actions. Because the very fact of declaring someone a rival is, in fact, itself an aggressive action. NATO is actually an instrument that was created for confrontation. The alliance has not strayed from this purpose. It remains true to its purpose. The main opponent of the alliance has always been initially the Soviet Union, then the successor state of the Soviet Union, which is Russia. And he then went on to say that the Russians are taking all the necessary steps to counter NATO's supply of weapon systems to Ukraine. All our relevant departments and the Supreme Commander-in-Chief, that's to say Putin, know perfectly well what to do. And believe me, everything that is necessary is being done to protect our interests. And in order to put aside any doubt as to who the adversary is, he then went on to say, it is an obvious fact the United States generally continues to supply weapons and military technologies to Ukraine. This is indeed true, and we know it. We have no illusions. Russian President Putin is well aware of this. So there we are. Whole succession of statements. And in some respects, it's not surprising, given some of the comments that were made at the NATO meeting in Ankara. Perhaps, possibly, you could argue that some of the statements that the Americans made, Trump and Rubio, partly triggered these harsh statements from the Russians. For example, Trump said that the Ukrainian strikes deep inside Russia were indeed escalation, but escalation that he hoped would force the Russians to the negotiating table. Rubio, the Secretary of State, spoke in even harsher terms about Russia being put under pressure in order to call the war off and essentially to capitulate. Trump also said that as part of some kind of security guarantees to Ukraine, the airspace over Ukraine should be treated as closed. Peskov, Putin's spokesman, has said essentially that this appears to amount to a American plan for a no-fly zone. In other words, a no-fly zone by the Russians over Ukraine. He said that this is a new proposition. It implies the presence of NATO forces in Ukraine. He reminded everybody that the SMO was launched precisely in order to prevent the deployment of NATO forces to Ukraine. And he said, essentially, that this is unacceptable. So, as I said, you could argue that all of these statements by the Russians are, to some extent at least, a response to the latest statements by NATO during its meeting and these statements by the Americans. But I'm actually going to argue otherwise. My own personal view is that the Russians have been steadily hardening their position since December of last year. They began to realise over the course of the autumn that the autumn of 2025, that the United States was not going to honour the agreements that the Russians say they made with the Americans at the summit in Anchorage. The Russians also, as I very well remember, were infuriated by Trump's decisions to impose sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft, which they saw as directly contrary to the agreements that were reached in Anchorage. The Russians were also infuriated by American discussions about supplying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, a plan which, by the way, I am confident never existed, and which was merely circulated in the United States in order to put psychological pressure on the Russians. And then, of course, there was the attack on Valdai, Putin's residence in Novgorod region, at a time when Putin was firstly on the phone to Trump and then asked by Trump to stay by the phone whilst Trump telephoned and spoke to Zelensky. And during that very same period between these two calls, the attack on Valdai took place. And this, a few days after Zelensky himself made a speech in Kiev to commemorate Christmas Day, the Western Christmas, in which he all but said that the Ukrainians wanted the assassination, the death of Putin. So the Russians have put all of this together a long time ago, and long ago concluded that negotiations between themselves and the Americans were not going to lead anywhere. And Lavrov has also said that the Russians, or at least he believes that Anchorage was a ruse, that the Americans were simply stringing the Russians along, and that the purpose of Anchorage was to get the Russians to agree to a ceasefire on the existing conflict lines. And given that that did not happen, well, we've seen that the Americans went for a policy of escalation instead. So the Russians are now utterly cynical about Trump. They're totally cynical about what proposals he makes on the conflict in Ukraine. Putin will talk to Trump. If Trump calls him, he will answer his calls. But as I pointed out, the telephone call between Putin and Trump that took place some days ago, if you pass Ushakov's account of it carefully, you can see that the call was contentious, that Trump again tried to put pressure on Putin, basically to agree to a ceasefire. Putin resisted, and the result was that despite Ushakov saying that the call was constructive, it cannot have been constructive because there is no evidence that the two leaders, in fact, agreed about anything. So, in reality, and in fact, we have total deadlock. And frankly, the antics at the NATO summit meeting will not have helped matters further at all. We had some truly bizarre things happen at that NATO summit meeting. Firstly, we had Trump appearing to grant Zelensky a license to produce, to manufacture the Patriot missile system. According to some reports, by the way, not all reports, some reports, Trump actually handed over to Zelensky the complete plans for the Patriot missile system. This is a preposterous proposal. First of all, Trump, who is the President of the United States, has no right or authority to grant licenses for production of Patriot missiles to a third country without first getting the agreement of the manufacturer, which is, of course, Raytheon Industries, a private company whose copyright, which has the intellectual property rights to the Patriot system. Anyway, there is no right. Trump was purporting to give Zelensky something that he doesn't have, the intellectual rights to build the Patriot missile system. But in any event, there is no possibility whatsoever that Ukraine itself can build Patriot missiles. The production of Patriot missiles is incredibly complex. Ukraine would have to set up its own supply chains, which inevitably is going to take time. Its territory is being regularly bombed and attacked by the Russians. As I said, this is a fantastic idea. And, well, of course, you could say that the actual production of Patriot missiles will not take place in Ukraine, but in Europe. But to the best of my recollection, the Germans were granted the license to build Patriot missiles some time ago, I believe about 2 years ago, and so far they have been unable to do so. As I said, this is a fantastic, ludicrous gesture. Perhaps Trump made it in order to basically get Zelensky off his back. But as far as the Russians are concerned, of course, they will see it, they will interpret it, not just as a further hostile move, but as further confirmation that the United States continues to involve itself in Ukraine, continues to supply weapon systems to Ukraine, continues to orchestrate Ukraine's deep strikes inside Russia. And the Russians, obviously, I'm not going to interpret any of that as a friendly gesture. Now, as I have said in the past, this idea that the Americans repeatedly seem to have, that bombing another country is a way of forcing that country to negotiate and agree to American demands, is one that never seems to die in the United States. They've been practicing it since the Second World War. I have never known it to succeed. And if we're talking about the current Ukrainian drone offensive against Russia, it is doing nowhere near enough damage anyway to put any kind of pressure of that sort upon President Putin or his government. It may be provoking mutterings of complaint against Putin in several places. But as I understand it, the overall mood in Russia, predictably, is hardening, with most Russians blaming the West and Ukraine for whatever difficulties this drone offensive is causing them, whatever lines there are in gas filling stations and that kind of thing. But there it is. Trump, Rubio, Radcliffe, the CIA director, who was the ultimate sponsor, apparently, of this idea. They are now committed to this policy. And of course, the policy continues. And frankly, I don't believe it is going to change. Meanwhile, of course, the war itself goes on. Whilst I have been here in Montenegro, the Russians carried out another big strike on Kiev, not quite as big as the previous two, but certainly powerful enough, and again apparently focused on destruction of weapons factories and those sort of things in and around Kiev. And of course, the Russians continue the methodical process of destroying gas filling stations across Ukraine, eastern Ukraine, every day. And apparently, there are now growing reports of fuel shortages in eastern Ukraine. Something, by the way, which Zelensky himself and the Ukrainian government, I notice, are not acknowledging. And by the way, I also notice that the Western media, which is grabbing at every opportunity to talk up the question of fuel shortages in Russia, is also saying very little, or in fact, in the case of the British media, essentially nothing about fuel shortages in eastern Ukraine. Anyway, that's perhaps where we are at the moment with the missile and drone wars. The Ukrainians are making some astonishing claims about their attacks on ships in the Sea of Azov, claiming, I believe, that 34 tankers were destroyed. As I've said in previous programs, drone hits are most unlikely to destroy tankers. They might damage them, they might even disable them for a time, but it's very unlikely indeed that these enormous ships and even small tankers, are strong and enormous ships, would absorb much damage. There's been some suggestions that it's the engines of these ships that the Ukrainians are mostly targeting, which is likely true. But anyway, I don't expect that this is going to be any very serious problem for the Russians. Maintaining the supply of fuel to Crimea and to Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, that does amount to a real serious problem. But overall, and in fact, the Russians undoubtedly will resolve it at some point over the next few weeks. And in the more northern regions of Russia, as I understand it, the fuel problems are indeed abating. Anyway, that's what I'm going to say about the situation there. Now, there have been more reports from the front lines in relation to the situation in the war in the sky. There's been a report that the Ukrainians were able to ambush and shoot down a Russian Sukhoi 35 jet close to the front lines, but flying over Russian-controlled territory. I'm not sure whether this report is true. I've not seen any confirmation from the Russians, but it might be true. If it is true, then I notice that, according to the Ukrainians, several F-16 fighter jets and a Patriot missile system were involved in this ambush, which basically confirms how difficult it is for the Ukrainians to shoot down Russian fighter jets. A solitary attack, a solitary shoot down of one fighter jet using these sort of resources is not going to be replicable across the entirety of the front lines. And if it is true that a Patriot missile system was used for this operation, then it looks to me to be a major misuse of resources. What the Ukrainians ought to be using their Patriot missiles for, one should assume, is to protect their ground installations, their factories and facilities in places like Kiev, not sending them across the battlefronts hunting occasional Russian fighter jets, of which the Russians obviously have no shortage. The Russians undoubtedly will track that Patriot missile system down now. When the Ukrainians used to do the same sort of thing, I believe it was in 2024, the only result was that a lot of Patriot missile systems, as I remember, were eventually destroyed by the Russians. Anyway, that's the situation in the sky. That's the diplomatic situation at the moment. The other thing that is happening simultaneously with all of these things are continued ground operations by the Russians. Now, many people, myself included, assume that the Russians would announce the fall of Lyman over the course of the NATO summit meeting. They have chosen not to do so. Nonetheless, I believe that Lyman is essentially under Russian control. The Russian Defense Ministry has curious habits about reporting captures. Perhaps they feel that it is still too close to the report of the capture of Konstantinovka in order to report the capture of Lyman. There are some reports that the Ukrainians have been conducting some kind of counterattack north of Lyman, in an area some distance away from Lyman itself, but to the north of it. And it may be that this is what has led the Russians to delay the announcement of the capture of Lyman. They want to deal with this counterattack first. But then against that, there are now confirmed reports that the Ukrainians carried out some kind of counterattack towards Konstantinovka after the Russians announced Konstantinovka's capture. And that did not obviously stop the Russians from announcing the capture of Konstantinovka, though the Russians do say that the counterattack on Konstantinovka itself was unsuccessful. Now, the most dramatic events on the battlefronts are now taking place in lots of different places at the same time. 2026, even more than 2025, is a year of Russian offensives all across the entire contact line, from all the way up in the north, where there is now apparently fighting going on for the capture of Beli Kolodis, which is now largely encircled, not entirely, but largely encircled by the Russians. Through Kupiansk, the Russians are now conducting heavy drone strikes on certain villages to the west of Kupiansk. Some are suggesting that this is to prevent any further Ukrainian counterattacks towards Kupiansk. I think it's more likely that these are preparations for a Russian offensive west of Kupiansk to capture these villages. But anyway, we will see. There is apparently now a growing battle in the Slavyansk area for control of the Slavyansk thermal power plant and the village of Nikolaevka. There is intense fighting going on for these two places. I say intense fighting. I'm not sure that it's correct to say that there's ground fighting. There's been reports that the Russians have troops in Nikolaevka and that their troops entered the Slavyansk thermal power plant. But there's been no drone footage that confirms the presence of the Russians in either of these places. But there is ample drone footage of very, very heavy bombing by the Russians of Ukrainian positions in these two places, just to say. And, well, Radovka provided a very detailed account yesterday of fighting in and around the town of Dobropilia, which is located to the south, to the west of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation. There were reports about a week ago that the Russians had managed to break into eastern Dobropilia. There's still no film footage of this, and Radovka has hinted at it, but never exactly confirmed it. But the Radovka is speaking of the Russians gradually fragmenting Ukrainian defences around Dobropilia, capturing ground which the Ukrainians are having to leave unoccupied because of the general shortage of Ukrainian infantry in the Dobropilia area, which is creating opportunities for the Russians. And lastly, if we go further to the south, there continue to be further reports of very heavy bombing and shelling by the Russians of Orekhov in the south, in Zaporozhye region. And again, all the indications appear to speak of a Russian preparation for a storming operation of Orekhov. The usual pattern of Russian offensives in the summer is that they start relatively slowly in April. They then gather momentum in May and June. Then there tend to be still more rapid advances in August and September. And then in October, we start to learn of the fall of the important towns. So I've no reason to think that this time it's going to be any different. It seems to me that this is exactly the pattern that is repeating itself this year in the offensive that is now taking place. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say about this issue. Now, on the question of the attrition war, I mentioned yesterday in my programme a long article that has been published in the Daily Telegraph by Ukraine's former military chief, General Zaluzhny. And he said something else about Ukraine's drone offensive against Russia, which I mentioned in the past, but which many people overlook or have missed. He made the point that Ukraine's drone offensive deep inside Russia itself is costly. It requires a very significant expenditure of resources. Yes, the drones are probably made in Europe, or at least put together in Europe from Chinese components. Yes, these drones do cause problems for the Russians. But overall, and in fact, the cost for the Ukrainians of conducting these kind of operations is not small. It requires significant diversion of resources, of drone operators and personnel of that sort, which perhaps could be more usefully applied on the front lines to try to stem the Russian offensives that are now accelerating and gathering pace. And, well, the other thing that this heavy reliance on drones is causing, the problems that are being caused by it, is that over the last few days, there have been increasing reports of successful jamming by the Russians of the Starlink system. Now, as I understand it, this is not happening so far in terms of the strategic drones, the drones that the Ukrainians are launching for strikes inside Russia itself, but it is becoming a growing problem for the Ukrainians on the front lines. The Russians have clearly been working on jamming systems for Starlink for quite a long time. At the time of the January protests in Iran, the Iranian authorities were able successfully to jam the Starlink system. I said at the time that I believe that the Iranians had obtained the technology from the Russians, and by the way, that has been confirmed to me by numerous sources. I also said that this came as a profound shock to the Americans and the Israelis, who assumed that the Starlink signals were unjammable, were jam-proof. Clearly, this was part of work that the Russians have been doing for a significant amount of time to work towards a jamming, successful jamming of the Starlink system. Now, there are apparently multiple difficulties. Any system can be jammed, but the nature of the Starlink system makes it particularly difficult. But then technologies evolve and develop all the time. And, well, I would not be surprised if the Russians are now well ahead in this game, because probably they are the first people who face the urgency of doing this. So this, as I said, is happening apparently on the front lines. It is not being widely reported in the West. We will see how to what degree and to what extent it develops. Anyway, even as all of this is going on, I discussed in yesterday's program the fact that that the attacks on the refineries and that the in Russia and as demonstrate and the fuel shortage in Russia and the Russian export ban on diesel seem to me to be likely to provoke many problems in the West, where there is now a significant fuel shortage, and especially a shortage of diesel. And well, sure enough, today an article has appeared in the Financial Times. World faces growing diesel supply crunch as Russia cuts off exports. And we're told the global diesel supplies are heading for a fresh crunch as Russia's ban on exports adds to strains caused by the Iran war, risking higher prices for motorists and farmers and threatening efforts to curb inflation. Storage levels were already running low before Putin blocked supplies from the world's second largest diesel exporter. And then it says, in a tacit acknowledgement of Ukraine's newfound success in launching long-range drone attacks on refineries. And then we go on to read that shipments of diesel and other products through the Gulf have slowed to a trickle due to the threat of further Iranian attacks. The double hit to diesel supplies saw wholesale prices in Europe soar, with their premium to crude oil reaching a high of $60.70 a barrel on Wednesday, as traders rushed to get their hands on tightening supplies. This means that despite the recent drop in crude oil, which has fallen back from highs of more than $100 a barrel during the Iran war to about $70 today, diesel is still trading closer to $135 a barrel, meaning motorists are not seeing the drop in crude feed through to forecourts. And then we go on to read in the article that there is some bafflement within the oil community as to why the Russians have announced this export ban on diesel, given that Russia always has a massive surplus of diesel. And inevitably, we have comments in this article like this. This has stoked suspicions. Russia has implemented the diesel ban to try to spread the pain to other countries, potentially seeking to influence Ukraine's backers to lean on Kyiv to ease off. Well, that's there in the article. Other parts of the article take a different view. My own view is that the Russians have explained the reasons perfectly clearly, given the panic and uncertainty about availability of petrol and diesel in Russia, and given panic buying and the need to create an oversupply of gasoline and diesel across the Russian market in order to stabilize the situation and ease prices. The Russians are flooding their economy with petrol and diesel by drawing on their reserves, and in the case of petrol, by importing petrol from third countries. So this is, in my opinion, the entire explanation of what is happening. I don't think that there is some cunning Russian plan to drain the Western economies of diesel or anything like that. But can I say that it still seems to me, as I discussed in my program yesterday, an eccentric decision, to put it mildly, to go on cheering Ukrainian attacks on Russian refineries when there is a general gasoline and fuel shortage. And elsewhere, I've been reading about increasing worries about the situation with natural gas, with European reserves for natural gas drained, or at least not drained, but only 75% full ahead of the peak summer and winter period. Again, it seems very strange that people nonetheless cheer on Ukrainian attacks on refineries and all of these things. But anyway, that doesn't seem to cause Western governments, including, by the way, the American government, any second doubts about assisting and facilitating these Ukrainian attacks. Now, at the end of the NATO summit meeting, President Erdogan gave all the NATO leaders a very strange present, a revolver, to each of them. And nobody has exactly understood what the purpose of this present was. Well, I can only guess. I wonder whether it was a hint from Erdogan about decisions that are being made, which, let's be gentle, might be construed as shooting oneself in the foot, to use that well-known expression. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.